No more questions? We're diving in. Are there any questions about any of the videos you've been watching? I know some people have already watched them. You don't have to. They're not due for another 2 weeks. But I know some of you have been, and I'm going to give you an opportunity to ask me anything about them. Some of them will be some shocking stuff that may take you aback, like the whole rapture lecture. No? Okay, if you do, by all means, ask. Today we're talking about genres, not genres. Wow. Genres. I know. The darn French word comes into our language, and we have to change the way in which we pronounce the G sound. My son, even this morning, was very frustrated with the street that we live off of, Yuma. He's like, why isn't it Yuma? He's like, there's no silent E to make it a long vowel. And I was like, that's the way the language works. It's like, it's like Genry, you know, but it's really pronounced genre because it comes from the French word, which means kind or type. Again, remember, we're laying foundational things. I'm not assuming that you don't know about genres, but we are going to talk about them again. Cool? It's a French word which means kind or type. In particular, a lot of times genre is talking about the kind or type of whatever we're talking about that can be categorized because they share similar elements. Is that a convoluted enough definition? The kind or the type of whatever it is that you are categorizing that shares similar elements. For example, if you go and you get a classical CD, or you download it from iTunes, whatever. Don't want to date myself. You get one and you're listening to it, and all of a sudden, right in the middle of it, a guy starts screaming and death metal starts to be playing. Would you think that you downloaded the right album? No. Why? Because it's violating the genre. Yes. It is violating it. That there are specific ways in which things are categorized that if something moves outside of that, it becomes anomalous. Because that's not the way the genre functions. And it gives you something. It's like, well, I mean, you know, I guess that this country music is also somewhat pop. But it doesn't always follow all the country music genres. Matter of fact, my grandma-in-law just can't stand Taylor Swift. Because she says, sorry, I know there's a love affair with some of you with her, but she can't stand her. She says she is not country. And she's having a crisis because it doesn't fit her genre. She has a predetermined understanding of the kind and type of music that country music should be. And whenever she sees a violation of that, it bothers her. Genre. And genre dictates, the way genre functions is very important to understand. We know a lot of times we talk in principles about genres and the different ones, the different categories. But there is a particular reason why we need to talk about genres that we'll get to in a minute. But first, I want to make a little bit of an example. Okay, we have a newspaper heading. What does that newspaper heading mean? Tigers, massacre, Indians. What?
Baseball.
Where, if it was baseball, it would be the Detroit Tigers just absolutely demolished the Cleveland Indians. What else could it mean?
There were tigers in India.
India.
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. There are, because the word Indians. Well, but that, even what you just said there, that's a major difference. Are we talking about people that are native to the continent of India? Or are we talking about Native Americans that were unpolitically correct calling them Indians? Here's my question. How do you know how to interpret that?
It's in the New York Times.
If it's in the New York Times, then what does it mean?
It's national.
Yeah, who knows? It depends on which section of the newspaper you're in. Right? Each section of the newspaper is a genre. Absolutely, it's a genre. So if you're in the sports section, The Detroit Tigers beat the Cleveland Indians. If you are in the international section, Tigers in India killed some Indian people. If you are in the local section, Tigers got loose from the local zoo, killed some Native Americans. Here's how genre functions. Here's how it functions. Is that humorous? I'm sorry. Let me give you time to experience this. Okay. The way in which we interpret the heading, the headline, is dictated by which genre that we are in, because that's the way in which the section of the newspaper is categorized. You would not think anyone died if in the sports section there was war imagery. Why? We use war imagery all the time in sports. But it makes sense because that's the genre that it's in. Right? I mean, think about football. Football is based off of war. He threw a long bomb. They're battling in the trenches. What do you think? The quarterback, he's the good general of his team. This is war imagery that makes sense in that genre. But if you take those same languages, that same language, and you pull it out into the international section, all of a sudden it all means something totally different. If somebody, you know, threw a long bomb, we may be talking about the way in which missiles can actually, you know, get to places that we didn't think they could get. And what genre does is it, now this is very important. Genre dictates the questions that we ask of the text. Genre's purpose is to dictate, is to give us the questions that we are to ask the section of the newspaper. It would not make sense for me to ask the question, who died, if I read this headline in the sports section. But it wouldn't make sense for me to ask who won whenever I look in the international section. There are specific questions that go with specific genres. And if you come to a genre and you're asking the wrong questions, you will get answers. But those questions were never meant to be asked to begin with. You see what I mean by that? How does that affect the book of Revelation? Or does it? No one? Really? How does that affect the book of Revelation?
It helps to look at it in its actual historical context and how it relates to the people around it instead of, you know, putting it into our present time.
Sure. Well, and what you're describing there is, in a sense, let me rephrase what you're saying, using some of the nomenclature I was just using. It tells you that asking questions that are predominantly about the present time or the future don't make sense because the genre wouldn't dictate that. See the difference? Man, a lot of times when we come to the book of Revelation, we're asking things like, when will the world end? That question is nullified if you know what genre is you're actually functioning in. It's kind of like me going to the fiction section and saying, which one of these books will help me get from Missouri to California? The question makes no sense. Because if I try to use one of the fictional books as a map, I'll end up in Narnia. Right? You don't use fictional books as maps. The questions that you ask about maps are completely different than the questions that you ask about the Chronicles of Narnia. Completely different. How do I know? The genre dictates it. What's hilarious, or not hilarious, what's interesting is the fact that you even laughed at my example. Because you are interacting with the genres, and because I crossed them, it was even humorous because it's so foolish. It is humorous because that is so foolish. And yet, when we come to Revelation and people are asking questions that the genre would never allow, we don't laugh. We buy into it hook, line, and sinker. You see the oddity in this? How do we know, how do we learn genres? You already know them. This is what I was thinking about this morning, is that our minds are fascinating because they automatically go through a lot of these processes of determining genres and which questions, even without us knowing what the word genre even means. We don't know we're doing it. We just intuitively get it. If I am wanting to know the score of the football games from this past Sunday, would it make sense for me to go to the TLC channel? No. Why? Yeah. Even the letters. All I have to do is just say three letters and you automatically know the question I'm asking doesn't make sense. Why? Because you understand the genre of the, what is it, the learning channel? Is that what that's called? The learning channel. You understand that genre so well that me asking what's the weather to that station is foolishness. Or if you're wanting to know about you know, what happened in Rome and you go to the sci-fi channel, you're not going to get your answers. You already know genres. You interact with genres every time you go into Barnes & Noble. Every time you go into libraries, every time that you even flip through all the albums on your iTunes, genres are everywhere at all times, and you're constantly filtering through them. And the reason why that you understand the questions to ask is because you are familiar with the genres that are being presented. Right? What happens when you're not familiar with the genres? Yeah. The book of Revelation is an unfamiliar genre. It is not one that you can go... You can't go to the Barnes & Noble section and find all the other Revelation books that we have. People still writing in that genre today. Because people aren't writing in that genre today. It has similar characteristics to other genres that we interact with in the Bible and even today. But in and of itself, it is a unique breed. Therefore, a lot of the times our questions when it comes to the book of Revelation are all over the map because we are not familiar with what we are dealing with. However, that would not have been a problem for the seven churches of Asia Minor. Because the genre of Revelation would have been as familiar to them as historical fiction is to us. They get it. And we'll actually read about that a little bit. What are the genres of the book of Revelation? Notice I'm using that word plurally. I don't know if that's a word, but... And for some reason that thing is cutting off the top of that PowerPoint in the sides. Awesome. This technology in this room is just astounding me. okay. The genres of the book of Revelation are threefold. Threefold. Now, question really quick. Do we understand mixed genres in our day and age? If I say there's multiple genres in Revelation, is that going to freak us out? No. Historical fiction, mixed genre. It is history, but it is fictitious at the same time. We get it. Even this whole phenomenon with the country moving over into pop type of thing, cross genres, some people handle it better than others. But we get it. It makes sense. First of all, the book of Revelation is the epistolary genre. It is a letter. A letter. How do we know the book of Revelation is in the epistolary genre? Yeah, yeah. Tell me where in Revelation, those of you that are studying for your... In what, chapters? Chapters 1, 2, and 3. Right off the bat say, this is a letter. And there are characteristics in this letter that you find in other letters in the Bible. For example, let me read. Revelation chapter 1, verses 4 through 5a, because we're not going to keep reading. John, to the seven churches in the province of Asia Minor, grace and peace to you from him who is and who was and who is to come, and from the seven spirits before his throne, and from Jesus Christ, who is the faithful witness, the firstborn from the dead, and the ruler of the kings of the earth. In the ancient world, it'd be like me saying, "Dear John." Whenever I say that, what do you automatically think? You're going to break something. Yeah. I'm going to write, oh gosh. Dear Larry, let me use a different name. Enough Taylor Swift for the day. I can only handle so much. Dear Larry, what does that mean to you? Yeah, and guess what? To the first century, that means nothing to them. Because that's not how they begin letters. They normally begin letters with at least three elements. Number one, and I like this first one, I wish we would do this, is they say who it is that is writing. It really doesn't make any sense to me the way we have our letters structured, because you have to like flip to the end in order to figure out who's writing it, and then you can go back to the beginning. It'd be really nice if it just said, Shane Wood, to the class of Revelation at 10 o'clock. You know, it makes sense. And that's the second element. Who is writing it? The second element is, who is being written to? To whom is the letter being written? So you have John to the seven churches in the province of Asia. That should help us dictate some of our interpretive principles that we go by. If John, the apostle, is writing to the seven churches of Asia Minor, all of a sudden, the last class period makes a lot more sense. Right? He's writing to these people. And the third thing you usually find in epistolary genre at the beginning is a salutation of some form. Grace and peace to you from him who is and who was and who is, and it keeps going on. As a matter of fact, out of the 22 New Testament epistles, only two of them, do not have all three elements up front. And that's Hebrews and 1 John. Those are the only two. Of the remaining 20, only three do not contain the words grace and peace in their salutation. Only three. So 17 out of the 22 pretty much follow this exact formula to a T. The exact formula to a T. So, right off the bat, we know what's happening here with John. Matter of fact, if you also look at Revelation chapter 22, verse 21, it says, "The grace of the Lord Jesus be with God's people. Amen." And if you've read other letters in the Bible, it would kind of like me saying, "Sincerely, Shane." You get it. He structures the beginning and the end of the epistolary genre. It's a big flag that he's waving around saying, listen, I'm writing this to a group of people. And we looked at this last time, but it is a group of people. It is a letter coming from the island of Patmos to Ephesus, and it's going across the mail route in Asia Minor. Therefore, it being the epistolary genre should not shock us. However, how does this realization form the questions that we ask? How does it impact how we interpret the book? Okay, what? Say it again.
How does it relate to other letters?
How does it relate to other letters? What is the normal function of letters?
To instruct.
Addressing the situation. In particular, especially with like Paul and other things, it is to instruct. Correct? Instruct who? Whom?
Sorry. Church.
The church. Yes. In particular.
Seven churches.
Well, here, the seven churches. Absolutely. Listen, this is very, very important for interpreting any book. Every letter in the New Testament is situational. Do you know what I mean whenever I say that? Every letter is situational. In other words, Paul didn't go, okay, it's time for me to write the doctrine that will shape the community from here on out. It'll be canonized several hundred years from now, and this particular book is going to be the manifesto of Christian doctrine. Paul never does that. What does Paul do? Wow, man, the Thessalonian church is going through a rough time right now. Because their leader was just pulled out overnight. And a lot of them are starting to wane in what they had committed to. And as a result, we get 1 and 2 Thessalonians. Wow, the Corinthian church is messed up right now. Just fallen. I mean, they're just a mess. I mean, there's divorces. I mean, not divorces. People are suing each other inside the church. You have this guy that's sleeping with his mother's, you know. So Paul says, okay, I need to write a letter, 1 Corinthians. Every letter in the entire New Testament is situational. Therefore, when we recognize the book of Revelation is in the epistolary genre, we should recognize the fact that it is written by a real person to a real group of people at a real time that are experiencing real issues that need to be addressed. Think about this. Everything we talked about last class period, all the different types of persecution they were experiencing, all the tensions from society and from the Jews that was surrounding them in that moment, all of that. And the very last living apostle is on the island and probably going to die. Do you think that situation would maybe prompt a letter? They're about to lose the last living link to Jesus. One of the last 12 to walk with Him. He's about to die. Don't you think that a letter would be appropriate? Of course. Does it mean that the church is going to fall because it has no leadership? No, there's other people in leadership. But there's something special about the apostles that once they all die, a major question in the early church would be, when they pass, then what? Then what? So, John writes Revelation to the seven churches of Asia Minor. Questions we need to be asking is, who is writing to whom? Why is the person writing? How does the book apply to the original audience, etc.? And these questions should guide then our interpretations. Second, Book of Revelation is the prophetic genre. Oh, mercy. I know you all have to listen to one of the videos on this particular issue, but I'm going to kind of go over some of that right now so that we understand even what the word means. Whenever I say the word prophecy or prophetic, in modern circles, in modern conversation, the colloquial understanding of this word is what?
Prediction.
Normally, the way in which we define the word prophecy, prophetic, is that prophecy equals prediction. Is that fair to say? A general observation of the way in which we function with this word. Overall, yeah, that's true. That people normally define it like this. Normally people define it like this. However, this was astounding to me. When you look up the word prophesy, to prophesy, and prophecy, you look all of them up, and there's a couple hundred. And I have looked them up, by the way. When you look them up, less than 17% of the time are they connected to or in the context of a prediction at all. Let that sink in for a second. That means over 83% of the time when the word prophecy, to prophesy, or prophecy is used, it has nothing to do with prediction at all. So what does it mean?
Foretell truth.
What's that? Say it again.
Basically, foretell truth. It's truth telling.
Yes. Okay. Prophets, this is the way I define prophecy. Prophecy reveals, it is a revelation of something, but it reveals, I think, three things. Number one, who God is. It answers an identity situation, because a lot of times people, when they rebel, it's because they forget either, number one, who they are, or more likely, who God is. That's what they forget. Rebellion usually has to do with an identity problem. Number two, prophecies reveal what God desires. And this, in this particular way, I'm using the word desires as what he longs to occur. Whether it be like in Daniel chapter 7, the coming of the one like a son of man, the establishment of his kingdom, what he desires. Number three, what God demands from his people. And D.B. Sandy, in the book Plowshares and Pruning Hooks, says this about prophecy. He says, describing the prophecy's function, Sandy writes, the function of prophecy was to make the prosecution and persuasion more convincing. In other words, prophecy occurs whenever there is rebellion on the horizon or currently in place. Always. Prophets are risen up because prophets are the mouthpiece of God to his people. That's what prophets are. Prophets are the ones that reveal, they pull back the veil of the way in which the world is perceived, and it says this is the way the world really is. So instead of Daniel chapter 2, whenever he sees this vision, Nebuchadnezzar sees this vision of the four, the statue made out of four different elements. And Daniel tells them, he interprets it, that it's what?
Four
kingdoms. Yes? He describes, the Babylon, and then it's going to move on to the Medo-Persians, and the Greeks, and the Romans. That's my interpretation. Some will disagree with that, but it doesn't matter, because that's where we're going. Don't have time to explain it. Daniel chapter 7, though, in a more prophetic interpretation of it, Daniel sees another vision, and this time it has four what?
Beasts.
Four beasts. And they had, one of them is like a lopsided bear, and one of them is this, ugly-looking bird-like figure. They all had, and the fourth one he can't even describe. It's so grotesque. It's worse than all the rest of them. What's happening there? Well, it's this. Daniel chapter 2 is the way in which the world perceives kingdoms. They're like rich metals. Gold and silver and bronze. But chapter 7 is the way in which God perceives those same kingdoms. They're beasts that devour His people and look to destroy His work. Which is an interesting parallel to Revelation 13, by the way. Yeah? See what's happening? In the prophetic genre, what he did is he pulled back the veil. And he said, let's see the world for the way it really is. From God's perspective. In that particular passage of Daniel chapter 7, you see the I forget which animal has the wings. But the wings are ripped off of it. And then you see another one whose heart, he's given a human heart and things of that nature. Underlying the vision of the beasts is that there is a God that is moving all of these kingdoms for His ultimate purpose. Even though they look like they're devouring all of His people and they are ruling the world. Daniel 7 says, no, God rules it. He is the all-powerful sovereign ruler over all of history. What does He desire? Daniel chapter 7 climaxes in verse 14 with the one like a son of man coming into the heavens. And what does it say about Him? That whenever He comes to heaven, His kingdom is established forever and ever. God desires for the messianic figure, the one like a son of man, one of the number one monikers that Jesus uses for Himself, especially in the Gospel of Matthew, son of man. Matter of fact, Revelation chapter 1, whenever He sees Jesus, what does He say in verse 13. And among the lampstands was someone like a son of man. Huh. Sounds Daniel-like. That is what God was desiring. For the kingdom to be established from the one like a son of man, otherwise known as the Messiah, otherwise known as Jesus. And what does God demand from His people? What's fascinating is the way in which Daniel ends. Actually, turn to Daniel chapter 7. Can't help myself. Chapter 7, verse 26. Verse 26, and we'll read through 28. But the court will sit, and His power will be taken away and completely destroyed forever. He's talking about the last beast. Then the sovereignty, power, and greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven will be handed over to the saints, the people of the Most High. His kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom, and all rulers will worship and obey Him. Majestic picture, right? Verse 28. This is the end of the matter. I, Daniel, was deeply troubled by my thoughts, and my face turned pale, but I kept the matter to myself. What troubled Daniel? That's an important question, right? This majestic picture of the fourth kingdom being destroyed, God's kingdom being given to the Most High, they establish the kingdom that reigns forever and ever. And then Daniel hears that, and the very next verse he says, I was deeply troubled, my face turned pale.
Because he's still in the first kingdom.
Because he's in the first beast. And what God has told him is this, this isn't even the worst one. It's going to get worse and worse and worse. And more are going to die and more suffering is going to occur. And your people and you are going to have to experience it. And what does he demand from you? Faithfulness in the face of persecution. This is the point. This is the point of Daniel 7. That God's people, even in the face of kingdoms that look like they're so powerful, even in the face of them, they can stand firm knowing that they will be reigning in a kingdom that lasts forever. See what's happening? If we focus only on the prediction, is there prediction in Daniel 7? Yes. Absolutely there is. But if we think that that's the point, that God is playing some cosmic fortune teller in the sky, that's what prophecy is all about, then you don't even understand why Daniel is writing to begin with, or Isaiah, or Ezekiel, or Jeremiah, or John on Patmos. Prophecy, primarily, is not, prediction is a peripheral issue. Does the book of Revelation contain some prediction? Yes, it talks about the second coming, yeah. Am I saying there's nothing to do with the future at all? No, it talks about the destruction of Babylon, doesn't it? But is that the purpose of Revelation? No. Why? Because prophecy surfaces out of a situation in which people are wavering in their dedication to Jesus. Therefore, he reveals to them who God is, what God desires to occur, and what he demands from his people. That's what Revelation is all about. And that's what prophecy is all about. Even, I mean, why was Isaiah writing? Why was Jeremiah writing? Jeremiah is talking about the impending doom that's coming on the people of God because of their rebellion. Right? Is he not, the whole point of prophecy, is it not to say, this is why you're guilty, so repent, people of God? We get so fascinated with the future elements that we're missing the message of the book. You're not understanding the questions you need to ask when you come to the prophetic genre if you're asking only about the future, because 83% of the time doesn't have anything to do with the future. You see what I'm saying? The prophetic genre affects the way we read Revelation because it starts changing our questions. How do we know the book of Revelation is prophetic genre? Revelation chapter 1, verse 3 says, "Blessed is the one who reads the words of this prophecy." Doesn't get much clearer than that, but you know what? It actually is called, referred to as prophecy three more times in Revelation. Revelation 22:7, Jesus describes the contents of Revelation as prophecy. Revelation chapter 22:10, an angel describes the book as prophecy. Revelation chapter 22, verse 18, John once again ending the book, describes it as prophecy. Prophetic genre is pretty clear in Revelation. But this is important because of this. Now, let me drive home my point one more time about the purpose of prophecy. Look at verse 3. This is in, Dr. Lowry brings out this point in his book, and I think it's brilliant. I think it merits restating. "Blessed is the one who reads the words of this prophecy, and blessed are those who hear it." What is it there?
Prophecy.
The prophecy. "And take to heart what is written in it." Terrible translation. Terrible translation. The word there for take to heart, what does that even mean? What does it mean to take something to heart? It's about as abstract and nebulous as you can possibly come up with. Therefore, the ambiguity of it allows it to mask what it really is saying. But the word actually means heed or obey. Heed or obey what is written in it. Here's my question. If prophecy equals prediction, how do you obey a prediction? There's going to be an earthquake in California. It's going to be a 10.0, and it will happen next week. Obey this prediction. You're going to die in 3 weeks at the noon hour. Obey this prediction. Okay, I'll make sure I run in front of a car. Like, you know, how do you obey predictions? Maybe we should redefine what the word prophecy means if he's asking us to obey it. Maybe it's not prediction that he's getting at. Maybe it's something like this. What God demands from his people because of their rebellion. Changes the questions that we ask. All of a sudden, I'm not asking, how's the future going to unfold? I'm asking, what is this revealing about who God is? What is this revealing about the way in which the world is really working? What is this revealing about the supernatural cosmic wars that are occurring behind the veil? What does this say about what the empires are telling me to believe and what is really true? What does this say about what God is demanding from me to function like in the present? See, that's one of the things in the book that you guys will be getting whenever it comes out in like a week or two or whatever. I write a chapter in there called In Defense of Eschatology. And my whole point is, every single time that anything about the new heavens and the new earth, or about the man of lawlessness, or the whole book of Revelation, every time, the question is always asked, how then should we live? Eschatology is about understanding what has happened in the past, understanding what is assured to happen in the future, and in light of that, how we are to live in the present. That is eschatology. And the emphasis is always how to live in the present. Always. He's demanding us to an ethic. He's not throwing out a jigsaw puzzle and saying, put the pieces together. Okay? All right. Final genre. Hey-o. Questions you can read. Apocalyptic. Say it with me, friends. Apocalyptic. What is the apocalyptic genre? I'm going to give you my long, convoluted definition of it, and we will go little by little. That's not the definition. Those are the questions. But we will go little by little on this definition and explain what I mean by it. Apocalyptic literature is a revelation of transcendent realities often communicated, I'm going to read this more than once, a revelation of transcendent realities often communicated by otherworldly beings. A revelation of transcendent realities often communicated by otherworldly beings with a great amount of symbolic language, with a great amount of symbolic language to comfort and exhort an oppressed people. Let me read that again. A revelation, apocalyptic literature is revelation of transcendent realities often communicated by otherworldly beings with a great amount of symbolic language to comfort and exhort an oppressed people. Okay, let's go little by little and see, describe what I mean by that. A revelation of transcendent realities. Apocalyptic literature is intended to talk about the realities that exist beyond the imminent. Do you know what the word imminent means? That which is close to us. That which in proximity is what we can, you know, a lot of times when I'm talking about the imminent reality, it's this. But what's the transcendent reality? That which is beyond this reality. And a lot of times you need the veil pulled back so you can see the way that empires really look from the eyes of God. A revelation of transcendent realities, oftentimes communicated by otherworldly beings. Apocalyptic literature, a lot of the times, you will have angelic beings or elders, as we see in Revelation, that are from heaven, that are revealing what is happening. And they usually are revealing it with a great amount of symbolic language. Symbolism is huge in the apocalyptic literature. Enormous! We'll talk about that next class. Symbolic language to comfort and exhort an oppressed people. In other words, the point of apocalyptic literature is to always help guide people that are being in an oppressive situation of how they are to live. There are, notice what I'm saying, apocalyptic literature, as if there is a category. This is very important. The book of Revelation is not the only apocalyptic literature that we have. It's the only one we use to predict the future and the tribulation and the rapture. But this isn't the only book that we have that would fall into the category of apocalyptic literature. Therefore, maybe the rules and the ways in which we read the other apocalyptic literatures should influence the way we read Revelation. Matter of fact, the very first apocalyptic literature that we have in existence is Daniel. At the time the book of Revelation was written, 95-96, we also would have had 1st Enoch. We would have had 4th Ezra, or also known as 1st and 2nd Esdras. Assumption of Moses. There are other apocalyptic texts. As a matter of fact, let me read to you one of them. Huh? 2nd Esdras, which is also 4th Ezra. If you ever see 4th Ezra, 2nd Esdras is within it.
Why is that?
I believe it's chapters 7 through 13 was literally known as 2nd or was originally known as 2nd Esdras. But it is also, those chapters are also included in 4th Ezra as a whole. And what's nice is that they correlate. So whenever you see 2nd Esdras 11, it's also the same as 4th Ezra 11. I'm going to read from 4th Ezra 11, and I'm just going to read some. And I want you to ask this question. Does this sound familiar? Okay? Or, even better yet, what is this? And this book, by the way, is written at the end of the first century, which is kind of like which book?
Revelation.
Okay? Now listen to this. 4th Ezra, 2nd Esdras. On the second night I had a dream, and behold, there came up from the sea an eagle that had 12 feathered wings and 3 heads. I looked, and behold, he spread his wings over all the earth, and all the winds of heaven blew upon him, and the clouds were gathered about him. And I looked, and out of his wings there grew opposing wings, but they became little, puny wings. But his heads were at rest. The middle head was larger than the other heads, but it also was at rest with them. And I looked, and behold, the eagle flew with his wings to reign over the earth and over those who dwell in it. And I saw how all things under heaven were subjected to him, and no one spoke against him, not even one creature that was on the earth. What does this sound like right now? What does it sound like?
Revelation 13.
But if let's just pull back. What we know of the time period in which these both were written, what does it talk about? Why would you say Rome?
The eagle.
The eagle. Hello. A beast coming out of the sea that looks like an eagle. What is the beast coming out of the sea referring to? Think. Apocalyptic literature. What other apocalyptic literature parallels that?
Daniel.
Chapter 7, the beasts come out of the sea. And what do those beasts represent?
Kingdoms.
So says the interpreter in Daniel chapter 7. So what would this be representing? A kingdom. The eagle was the key symbol, not of America, but America ripped it off from Rome. As a matter of fact, I was reading the other day in The Grand Strategy of the Roman Empire by Edward Luttwick that even some of the legions were disbanded because they lost their eagle Roman standard. Their banner that they carried into battle, all of the legions had a big eagle on it. And if they lost it, it was punished by disbandment. The eagle was the primary sign of showing the dominance of the world. And here in 4th Ezra, an eagle is coming out of the sea. And it starts talking about how it reigns and soars over all of creation. And no one would speak a word against the eagle. Why? Because if they did, they would be punished. When you're reading the book of Revelation, it's dealing with images that would have been very familiar to them. This is not the first apocalyptic literature that we have in existence. There are a bunch of it. And when you read them, they sound an awful lot alike. In just a bit, when we get to chapter 12, Ezra, he says, "Then I awoke," and then he looks over and he sees an angel and he asks them to interpret the dream. And the angel takes him on this visionary journey and he starts explaining what the dream means. Kind of sounds like Revelation. And Daniel, right? My point is this. Apocalyptic literature shouldn't scare us. We should just recognize the fact that it is not familiar to us. But just because it's not familiar to us doesn't mean we can do with it whatever we want. Right? Right. So, how do we know the book of Revelation is apocalyptic literature? Well, number one, the very word apocalyptic comes from the very first word of the book of Revelation. Apocalypsis. In Latin, it would be revelatio, revelation, from where we get the word revelation. So even the word that describes the actual genre itself is derived from the first word of revelation because it's a pretty good example of it. Also, do I want to talk about that? Yeah, we have time. Also, the book of Revelation emphasizes the fact that it is communicating through symbols. Yes. I am okay with the whole accusation. I take the Bible literally, but you take it figuratively. Yeah, because it tells me to. Like, it's kind of the same. What is the word? And I think you guys have to listen to this lecture too, I think. But I ask the question, what does the word literally even mean? What does it even mean? If I say to you, man, I'm on top of the world. Does that mean that I'm arguing that the world actually has an apex on which I am standing? No, what does it mean? I'm ecstatic. Things are going well. That's literally what I'm saying. Because I am literally using a symbol. And if the text is literally using a symbol, then you need to interpret it as a symbol. Man, you guys are driving me crazy. Does that mean that I really think that you guys have put me in a vehicle and driving me to the location called crazy? Literally, that's what I would be saying. No. I'm saying, you're annoying me. Literally, that's what I'm saying. But I've literally used a symbol. Actually, literal comes from the Latin word lettera, which means letter by letter. So if the letters combine in order to communicate through a symbol, you need to take it symbolically. We do this all the time in language. All the time. The sun's setting. No, it's not. The earth is rotating. Literally, you look like a fool if I'm using literal in the sense of on the surface. That I have to take it exactly the way it says. No, if it's using a symbol, let it be a symbol, daggone it. That's the way all of language functions. Why all of a sudden we want to change it when we come to Revelation? I have no idea. All of language functions. We function without even... I use so many symbols in the words that I speak that I don't even recognize them. I don't even recognize it because that's the way language works. Try to speak the whole day without using one symbol and you will go insane. Revelation tells us it used symbols in a couple of different places. Revelation chapter 1, verse 1 says, "The revelatio, of Jesus Christ. Actually, if you're in Latin, the V would be a W sound, but try saying revelatio. It's really hard to say. Revelatio. Anyway, the revelatio of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show his servants what must soon take place. He made it known by sending his angel to his servant John. Dr. Lowry is right whenever he says NIV botched that up again. Made it known. In the King James Version, who actually gets it right, is the word signified or made known through the use of symbols. Revelation chapter 12, verse 1 uses the exact same Greek word. A great and wondrous sign appeared in heaven. A great and wondrous sign. Same word as made it known here. It's symbols. As a matter of fact, there are three different places, actually there's more than that, but we're going to look at three different places in Revelation where John screams at the top of his lungs, I'm using a symbol! And if you don't get it, then you're just not paying attention. Revelation chapter 1, verse 20. This is Jesus actually speaking. Because remember, John sees the magnificent Jesus come on the island of Patmos. And he's walking through seven golden lampstands and he's holding seven stars. And in verse 20, Jesus says, the mystery of the seven stars that you saw in my right hand and of the seven golden lampstands is this. The seven stars are the angels of the seven churches. And the seven lampstands are the seven churches. What is he doing? He's interpreting the symbols for us. Right? Revelation chapter 12, verse 9. We've just got done with the picture of the nativity scene where the dragon is trying to devour the baby. The baby is pulled up to heaven. He goes after the woman. The woman is protected. He gets ticked off, says, I'm going to make war in heaven in verse 7. Verse 7 and 8, he's fighting, but he gets thrown down. And in verse 9, it says, the great dragon was hurled down. Then there is a, usually in the interpretations, it'll have a dash. That is, that ancient serpent called the devil or Satan who leads the whole world astray. What did he just do for me? Yeah. In case you miss it, the dragon is a symbol for Satan. I want to make sure we're all clear, John says. The dragon is the serpent, Satan, the one who leads the whole world astray. Do I need to say it more? He says. No, it's a symbol. Revelation chapter 19, verse 8. We just got done with the destruction of Babylon in chapter 18. Celebration breaks out in verses 1 through 6 of 19. And right in the middle, I love this, in verse 6. It says, then I heard what sounded like a great multitude, like the roar of rushing waters and like loud peals of thunder, shouting, Hallelujah! For our Lord God Almighty reigns. Let us rejoice and be glad and give Him glory. For the wedding of the Lamb has come, and His bride has made herself ready. Fine linen, bright and clean, was given her to wear. And then in parentheses it says, fine linen stands for the righteous acts of the saints. What did he do? What did he do? Yeah. He says, the fine linen that they're wearing stands for the righteous acts of the saints. So the question then becomes, how did the bride make herself ready for her Savior? By what she was doing during the times of persecution. See what he's doing? He's saying, symbols. They're symbols. And in case you miss them, I want you to get them. They're symbols. Yes?
When John has this kind of like these dashes and explanations, are these pretty much unanimous throughout all the manuscripts? Or?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
No.
It almost seems like, you know, sometimes...
Interpolations.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. No. Yep. Good question.
What would you say to someone, I know I've been told this before, who says, yes, John will... tell you what the symbols are when they're symbols. Mm-hmm. The rest is to just be taken.
That's why Revelation chapter 1 verse 1 is very important. That the revelation of Jesus Christ that was given by God to the angels to give to John was made known through symbols. And this isn't like this the only three times that it's used. As a matter of fact, then I would look at them and say, okay, so you're expecting these locusts then to come? And to actually, or I ask them this question. Okay, well, because this, sometimes if I take the images actually literally, whenever he doesn't even tell me, it doesn't make any sense. One example, he comes in Revelation chapter 1 and in Revelation chapter 19 with the one, like the rider of the white horse, comes with the sword coming out of his mouth. So that's not a symbol because John didn't tell me it was. So he's a sword swallower. I don't know how he speaks. I think it would probably gag him. But he does speak. Or, for example, the elder, whenever John is weeping because he's longing for someone to be worthy to break open the scroll, he says, look, the Lion of the tribe of Judah. And he looks, and what does he see? A slain lamb. Now, am I to think that he really means only a lamb? Is that as far as I can take that language? No! Who is he talking about? How do you know it's Jesus? I never said his name. Because the slain lamb means one thing to us. It is the sacrifice by which we are saved, and Jesus did that. Right? But he never tells me that's what the symbol was. He has made his case clear. This is apocalyptic literature. We make things known through symbols. Therefore, there are some symbols I want to make sure you don't miss. But the other ones you'll get. Why? We'll talk about why next class. But, or for example, he promises the church in Philadelphia that if they overcome, he will make them a pillar in the temple of God. Then they get to Revelation chapter 21, and what does he say? When I was up in the new heavens and new earth, there was no temple. So did he lie to the church of Philadelphia? Were these people literally going to be columns inside of a structure that doesn't exist? No, because language doesn't work like that. And we know it doesn't. And people are playing games to fit their theology into something that doesn't fit whenever they're trying to bring up the fact he's not using symbols. That's bogus. I'm not even tracing the words like or as. I mean, aren't those key indicators of similes, which is symbolic language? The one seated on the throne was shining like jasper and carnelian and... Come on. It blows my mind when we come to Revelation that we just throw out all of the things that we intuitively know about language so that we can force a theological system onto something that was never even intended to be talking about. Use what you know. It's very clear that he's using symbols the same way that you are able to interpret my symbols. The reason why we don't get it is because the genre is foreign to us. But it wouldn't have been foreign to them. Yes?
Is there any genre that would give people who believe in a literal interpretation, like the idea that everything should be taken literal? Like narrative, it is very literal, but is there any time where you...
Kind of. See, and here's the problem. This is the problem of the Enlightenment. Even narrative is not always literal. I mean, hello. This may freak some people out, but I had a girl ask me in my Matthew class at the end of the semester. She says, Matthew chapter 26, the Last Supper scene, it says it happened 2 days before the Passover. Where John chapter 13, which is the parallel, or 12... I don't remember, one of those two. It's parallel, says it's 6 days. How do you reconcile that? And my response to her was, I don't. Because the writers can sometimes talk about things and have a different purpose than counting days. For John, 6 is a pretty important number. Yeah? Because it's right before completion. In the time of the Passover... It's right before the completion on the cross. But you know what's also important for John? The number 8. Because that number stands for the resurrection. He's getting there, but he's not there yet. We need to ask what the author's writing and why he's writing it. Instead of saying, even the narrative genre has to function just by giving us facts. That's not the way the narrative genre functions all the time. Can it at other times? Absolutely. Absolutely. But a lot of times people take Paul's letters and they say, this didactic teaching is exactly what Revelation is doing. To which I respond, not even Paul uses all literal language. Have you read 2 Thessalonians 2 today? Or 2 Thessalonians 1? Or 1 Corinthians chapter 15? Or, I mean, my word! I mean, the word body of Christ that he calls us, what do I do? Do I have to take that literally? Come on, language doesn't work like that. Let language work. Quit playing games to try to fit theological agendas into something that's not there. Let it work. And whenever it works, it is beautiful. Do I have time for anything else? Oh, let me say this though. The reason why the apocalyptic literature, and especially the book of Revelation, and a lot of times symbols are implemented at all, is because they're interacting with things that simply transcend language. Our language is great, but it is very limited. It can only accomplish so much. And at the point whenever we realize that our language is failing is always the point that we move into poetry and not prose. Always. We always move into poetry whenever we are trying to stretch the languages of our limit or of our the limits of our language to its breaking point. This is the concept of music. The concept of music always uses symbols because they're trying to communicate emotions that literal language cannot achieve. For example, if I stood up here and told you that I can give you a logical syllogism that explains exactly the way that I feel to my wife, you could very easily see the futility of language. Because it is beyond what our language can capture. How do you describe God literally and capture it all without using symbols? Please tell me. You see what I mean? Matter of fact, First Enoch, which is another apocalyptic literature, by the way. Where's my little deal here? First Enoch, I love this. I was reading this morning, and this stuck out to me. He's describing his visions, and he says, "And behold, there was an opening before me, and a second house." He has just gone through this amazing house. "A second house, which is greater than the former. And everything was built with tongues of fire. And in every respect, it excelled the other." Now listen to this. "In glory and great honor. To the extent that it is impossible for me to recount to you concerning its glory and greatness." And then he goes on from there to try and give you an account of what he just saw. But what did he just say? "My language is going to fail, but I'm going to do the best I can." That's where symbols come in. That's what apocalyptic literature is doing. How do you describe what is behind the veil? How do you describe the way in which you look through the eyes of God? Or you look upon God's face Himself? How do you describe what Jesus did on the cross for you without using symbols? It is whenever we interact with the things that are beyond us, beyond what this physical world can contain, that we have to move into poetry. We have to. Because our language, no matter how effective it is, it becomes quite feeble whenever I'm trying to describe that which is beyond me. You see what I mean? I'm not asking you to become artsy-fartsy. I'm asking you to think about the way you function every day. Whether or not you're good, this is why I was telling Natalia that because she enjoys art and the things like that, I said, "You're going to love Revelation." Because people that have a more artistic bent, they get it. Matter, I'll tell you this. Two people that really understand Revelation the best are people that are very much artistic and people that are suffering. Why? Because people that are suffering are experiencing something that is simply beyond what words can contain. The emotions that they're going through and how they deal with them are something beyond what language can capture. When they come to the book of Revelation, they hear very loudly the call of Jesus, of what God demands of them. They resonate with it deeply because apocalyptic literature is targeting the emotion to catalyst them to become something that God wants them to be. And simply me looking at you and saying, "Stand firm for Jesus," is different than me describing you the majesty of reigning with God as a martyr on the thrones in the kingdom that reigns forever. You get the same point. But you also grab the emotion that takes you to a whole new level of understanding. And that's what these genres do. And if we ignore genres, just like context, we can make the book say whatever we want. But we need to understand that he wrote it in this way for a specific reason. And paying attention to that will do us a great service of interpreting it the way he desired for it to be interpreted. Next class, we have our In What chapters, and we will talk about symbols. I have 1 minute. Are there any questions? I'll give you the best 30-second answer I can.
Are there any extra-biblical or non-Jewish apocalyptic?
Oh yeah, matter of fact, the stuff I was reading right there is Jewish.
Outside of like the Jewish history or like not biblical apocalyptic, there's something that would be like Egyptian or other.
Oh, I see what you're saying. I don't know. I don't know if I can answer that. It is the very first apocalyptic literature in that it was Daniel, and then it's manifested itself in other Jewishness, Jewish-like literature, tells me that the Jews very much had a handle on the apocalyptic literature, John himself being a Jew. But I don't know if I know of a Roman apocalypse. But Rome didn't need an apocalypse. Their entire myth explained reality. Yes?
You said that you looked up two prophecy, prophesy, and what other word?
Prophecy. Prophecy, prophesy, and two prophesy. Okay, you're dismissed. Love you guys. See you Friday.